That at 9 o'clock, the Old Mall Variety Hour is on. 10 o'clock, Locus Focus. 11, Radio Zine. And 11:30, Madness Radio. All of these KPOO programs are made possible by member support. That's you when you are a member. If you're not, donate. Become a member of KPOO at kboo.fm and click on donate. And we'll thank you mightily for it.
Tune into KPOO Tuesday, November 6th from 6 to 10 p.m. for election night coverage. We'll have national coverage by Pacifica and Native Voice One. And at 8 p.m., our local news team will provide election results and analysis. Again, that's election night coverage Tuesday, November 6th, starting at 6 p.m. after the KPOO Evening News here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KPOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Top Dog Underdog, running Friday, November 9th at the Chapel Theater in Milwaukee. Top Dog Underdog tells the story of a sibling rivalry between African-American brothers in a turbulent relationship punctuated with dark humor. Their names are Lincoln and Booth. This show has adult content and is not recommended for children. Again, that's Top Dog Underdog, running Friday, November 9th at the Chapel Theater, 4107 Southeast Harrison Street in Milwaukee. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Johnnie sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Johnnie sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. Our theme song was performed by Joe Clement. KBOO programming is made possible by KPOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. The Old Mole takes its name from Karl Marx's term for the revolutionary forces that subvert the terrain of capital and capitalism. Elections and government policies are not those revolutionary forces, of course, but they can shape the terrain on which, or under which, we struggle for a better, more livable world. So, Oregon voters, you have until tomorrow at 8 p.m. to drop off your ballot at an official ballot drop box. On today's show, Bill Resnick talks with Chuck Collins of the Institute for Policy Studies about what we might expect from the elections and where we might go from there. Tom Becker will share a reading about why America's Constitution won't save us from Trump. And new mole, Dan Jaffe, will talk with Russell Lum, Trade Justice Coordinator of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, a coalition of more than 30 labor, environmental, and human rights organizations. They'll discuss Trump's recent renegotiation of NAFTA, the 24-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement, and what it means for capital, labor, and the environment. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. If you have comments, suggestions, questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at Old Mole Variety Hour, all one word, at gmail.com. Before we turn to Bill and Chuck Collins, I want to share a reading from Zoe Leonard. This is a clip of her reading a text that she wrote back in 1992, followed by the comments that she made about it when she read it in 2016, shortly before the presidential election. This is Zoe Leonard reading, I Want a Dyke for President.
I want a dyke for president. I want a person with AIDS for president. And I want a fag for vice president. And I want someone with no health insurance. And I want someone who grew up in a place where the earth is so saturated with toxic waste that they didn't have a choice about getting leukemia. I want a president that had an abortion at 16, and I want a candidate who isn't the lesser of two evils. And I want a president who lost their last lover to AIDS, who still sees that in their eyes every time they lay down to rest, who held their lover in their arms and knew they were dying. I want a president with no air conditioning, a president who stood online at the clinic, at the DMV, at the welfare office, and has been unemployed and laid off and sexually harassed and gay-bashed and deported. I want someone who spent the night in the tombs and had a cross burned on their lawn and survived rape. I want someone who's been in love and been hurt, who respects sex, who's made mistakes and learned from them. I want a black woman for president. I want someone with bad teeth and an attitude. I want someone who has eaten that nasty hospital food, someone who cross-dresses and has done drugs and been in therapy. I want someone who's committed civil disobedience. And I want to know why this is impossible. I want to know why we started learning somewhere down the line that a president is always a clown, always a John and never a hooker, always a boss and never a worker, always a liar, always a thief, and never caught. I wrote this text 24 years ago. It's been circulating a lot lately, which has been a bit of a dichotomy for me. On the one hand, I'm thrilled and gratified that something I made more than 20 years ago is still considered relevant. At the same time, I'm utterly horrified and sad that something I wrote more than two decades ago still has such relevance. This is not a text I would write today. I don't think about identity politics in the same way. That is, I don't think that a specific set of identifiers or specific demographic markers necessarily leads to a particular political position. I think that what's going on in the text is both a real call and a metaphoric one. Yes, I want a real person in that office, someone intelligent, experienced, and compassionate. But this text also asks for something beyond any one person. It's a question of power. Who has it? Who gets a voice? Why are some of us marginalized while others are ushered in? This is a structural question. This is a conceptual question. This is a real life question. How do we choose to govern ourselves? I think about the gap from 1992 to today, all we've gained and all the ground we've lost. We all have our ideas and our lists. Is it two steps forward and one step back? Or one step forward and two steps back? I'm not sure. And yet, I suppose I'm here today because I am still taken by the idea that government can not only be of the people, and for the people, but most importantly, by the people. And that means us, you and me, all of us here today, right now.
If you see me stumble, don't stand back and look on.
That was Zoe Leonard reading her 1992 text, I Want a President, and talking about it at that 2016 reading, followed by a little snippet of Bernice Johnson Reagan and Sweet Honey in the Rock singing Give Your Hands to Struggle. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, where we dig into the possibilities for government by the people and the grassroots struggles to make it more possible. We turn now to Bill Resnick and Chuck Collins of the Institute for Policy Studies.
Hi, Chuck Collins. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Chuck Collins writes, speaks, agitates, organized. He's based in Boston with the Institute for Policy Studies and directs their program on inequality and the common good. The Institute, of course, is in Washington, D.C. His program is exposing spectacularly increasing inequality and the insecurity and anxiety it creates. It's also proposing alternative policies and seeks to build and advance all our justice movements from below. His books include How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. And he just released a study, Billionaire Bonanza 2018. This is the third in the series of billionaires as they grow ever richer. Chuck Collins, tomorrow is an important midterm election, to say a plebiscite on Donald J. Trump. Some of us leftists, those with sunny dispositions, are elated with the latest polls and trends in voting, especially much greater participation by the young, which is really good. But elation is not me. I have hope that Trump's repudiated, but on the whole, I dread the results. But dread's a lousy feeling. It's not healthy. And so on second thought, I remind myself, don't obsess about the election. No matter the outcome, a lot of things will remain the same. That is, things will get worse, meaning inequality and climate change. But we are not powerless. We have the policy answers. We have strong movements. In the future, people may well turn to us to direct economic and social reconstruction that is so necessary and will become more necessary. So for those of you with dread, that's the way to comfort yourself and not get demoralized. Chuck, let's look at two scenarios. The first, the Republicans keep both houses of Congress. The second, that the Democrats win at least one house. Maybe start with the Republicans if they keep control. What can they do? What can we do?
I think, Bill, either way, and let's say the Republicans keep both the House and the Senate, I mean, I think that would be incredibly discouraging. I would be sad to think that even in this environment, but I actually think it shows the power of minority rule kind of still running its course. I mean, if Republicans maintain the House, it's because they have successfully whipped people into a fearful frenzy, that they've gerrymandered and suppressed the vote in a lot of areas. It doesn't hide the fundamental good news, which is there really is a realignment happening. People want to live in a very different society than the one we are currently living in. We just haven't been able to execute it politically. I also think that the last 2 years have been kind of an unusual alignment. I think that the Republicans are going to start to fracture more, and I don't think they'll be able to push their pro-corporate, anti-environmental agenda quite as successfully as they have the first 2 years. They're going to have less power politically and culturally.
You think even with the, that is, our movements and popular opinion, you see it running against them, as it did, for example, in the affordable, when they tried to eliminate the affordable Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, they really ran into a buzzsaw and many of them shied away from destroying it, including, actually, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who was the deciding vote in a decision to not declare it unconstitutional. So you see people waking up and popular movements gaining force that would keep them from doing the worst of their ideas.
Yeah, and I think even if the Republicans dominate the House still, I think that there's so many districts now where things are close and movements are getting stronger. And as you pointed out, younger people are getting more engaged, women electorate, you know, all across the board, we're seeing a kind of awakening and a pushback. And there are going to be a lot of states and cities. I think we are going to see some state legislatures shift, which is reversing the trend, really, of the last 20 years. I think the northern Midwest, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, some of those states are going to, you know, shift in terms of power. So there's going to be more brakes put on the kind of runaway pro-corporate agenda.
What about their Mitch McConnell gave a speech, and Paul Ryan is talking about it. They seem to think that since the federal government is running such huge deficits that it's really necessary to cut all the, quote, entitlements like Social Security and Medicare. Are they actually going to try that? It seems to me that would be somewhat suicidal for them, but they're men of their convictions.
Yeah, I think that they will try it. What's fascinating is how unpopular the first Trump tax cut is and how people totally understand that these deficits are a function of a tax cut that mostly went to fewer than 1,000 corporations and mostly to very, very wealthy people. So it's fascinating to see, you know, none of these Republicans are boasting and running on that tax cut. And I actually think that they, before they can go down the buzzsaw of trying to get rid of Social Security or cut Medicare, they're going to have to reckon with the fact that, you know, a huge amount of that deficit is their own damage that they've caused. And people see it, you know. So I think that's a really encouraging sign. I don't think they're going to get very far with that agenda. And the idea of a middle-class tax cut is simply acknowledging that they failed to convince people that they've helped them. So I think that won't get anywhere either. And we may actually see a repeal or rolling back some aspects of the Trump tax cut.
My sense is that through the Trump years, they're going to, if we have a bit of luck and some huge storm aims itself at Mar-a-Lago and reduces it to a debris in the ocean, which is not inconceivable. It's not very far above the waterline, but there'll be other storms and other great wildfires, all of the rest. I think people are waking up to the fact that climate change is a serious threat, not just to their grandchildren, but to their children and even to themselves. It seems to me that the Republicans are on extremely weak, fragile ground, like Miami is, in continuing to promote coal mining, of all things, and many other horrible things.
Yeah, it's clear that it's going to be more and more obvious that they're on the wrong side. You know, Gaia has other plans, Mother Nature bats last, and I think states and cities are kind of moving forward. You know, I think it'll be interesting to see the outcome in Washington State of the carbon tax initiative. A lot of cities are continuing to move forward in their commitments to the Paris Accord. So I think it will only become more obvious as we go through another, you know, hurricane season, as we go through another summer wildfire season and other forms of weird weather, that we've damaged, the Earth's thermostat, and we have to intervene immediately, ideally 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but we can act rapidly, but it's going to take a certain new generational leadership and a group of people who are currently not in the political system. I mean, we're dealing, Bill, as you talk about all the time, you know, with deep system problems, these inequalities, the climate crisis, Republicans, Democrats come and go. These are trends that are marching forward. You know, it's great if things shift one way or the other more positively politically, but the work is the same. It's really, you know, building power, building social movements, helping prepare our communities for ecological and economic transition. All those are things that we're going to do regardless of who's elected at the top.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Chuck Collins, who directs the program on inequality and the common good, which exposes inequality and insecurity And it also advances a whole lot of programs that are possible. We've just talked about that even if the Republicans remain in control, they are on very shaky ground. And unless we get immensely discouraged and demoralized, if we keep up the organizing and continue in many places to build the future, it's actually happening in the United States. It seems to me that economic and environmental demands, requirements, will shape the future. And the future then is open for, in fact, a really democratic reconstruction. Chuck, what if the Democrats win? I'm a little afraid that they will win a House, and that Trump, in his self-aggrandizement and interest in his own popularity, could well sort of fashion terrible compromises with conservative Democrats. That is, they could, for example, go with the investor-owned utilities in California and the finance industry. That the utility bonds are very important to the finance industry, always have been. They could go with them and, in fact, create big subsidies for them to regain control of energy and create huge wind and solar plantations, and with public subsidies, immense trillions of dollars for a reconstructed grid that would still be subject to huge storms and interruptions. It would have to be highly secure. Chuck, what if the Democrats win? I think win one House. It would be good, but I think there's also, because many of them are conservative, you could see an enormous realignment in the U.S. Apparatus, the government apparatus, the federal government.
Yeah, I think that's a real risk, you know, because as we've seen in the past, the Democrats, there's a certain wing of the Democrats that just go along with conservatives on energy policy, housing and real estate, you know.
Technology.
More focused on the financial sector, you know, Wall Street. One thing that's encouraging, if the Democrats take the House, it's very interesting to look at who becomes committee chairs, though. And it's very, very strong progressive. For some reason, there's some progressives that have just lasted a long time in the House, and they are moving into senior roles. You know, there'll probably be 85 members of the House Progressive Caucus, and a lot of key committees will be chaired by progressives. So that means that there'll be the ability to stop the bad, you know, block bad policy proposals. You never would have seen a tax cut like the one that went through. It's the power to hold hearings and kind of help change the conversation and investigate corruption. So the good news is we'll create some room to move. You know, I think special movements will be able to put pressure on the House. And, you know, the next cycle coming up, 2020, not only the presidential election, but a lot of Republican senators are up for re-election in 2020. So you're beginning to lay the groundwork for some of those, even the Republican senators who want to stay in office, are going to have to kind of move with the times a little bit. So it'll be the beginning of a much more well-understood realignment politically and culturally. You know, when Obama came in 2008, similarly, a lot of progressives became chairs of committees, and they were able to use that bully pulpit to really focus attention on some important things.
Yeah, you can. It's easy to imagine that if progressives stay strong and continue to speak for a reconstructed economy on democratic, small-d democratic lines, that they could have a huge amount of influence, maybe not in moving towards, let's say, a $20 minimum wage or Medicare for all on the French and what was once the British lines, somewhere in between. But if it may be that we couldn't win those sorts of, quote, reforms, radical reforms, we could win, my guess is, support by the national government for, let's say, model cities or model programs or some way of showing the success of the radically democratic model of energy and healthcare.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think, you know, one thing I've noticed is our revolution and the sort of the Bernie Sanders movement, even now, has been incubating progressive healthcare policy. But I think, you know, we're going to start to see sort of a movement for college for all, a more progressive tax system, something that actually reverses the tax cuts and actually addresses wealth at the very, very top of the economy. You know, so I think there's, you know, a wing of the progressive Democrats who really understand that it's all about building movements, it's about building support in the districts, and about educating the public about alternatives. And that's where I think the work has already begun, but it's going to get an enormous boost regardless of what happens tomorrow.
Yeah, there seem to be a lot of candidates who have decided to take really principled and radical positions, practical radical positions. Medicare for All is hardly, as Trump calls it, a communist and a radical program. Almost every other industrialized country in the world has something like that. There's really a lot of promise. Why don't you conclude?
Yeah, I think you know, the forces of change are moving in the right direction. It's easy to get discouraged when you look at Trump and sort of national policy. But what keeps me optimistic is looking at the base. You know, looking at the level of organizing that's happening, looking at where people's public opinion is at. You know, people want to have higher living wages. They want to address the climate crisis. They want to live more in harmony with the Earth's boundaries. They believe the rich should pay more in taxes and not have as much power politically. You know, we're talking like 70-80% of the population lines up behind some of these basic ideas. And that will keep moving. That will keep happening. It will help if the Democrats win the House tomorrow, because then we can get a little bit off of the defense of just trying to stop horrible bad things from happening and be able to, you know, create some space for social movements and for positive things to happen. So, unless there's a complete and utter disaster that none of us foresee, I think there's going to be some cause for happiness tomorrow.
Yeah, and for continuing commitment to this whole movement building process. Chuck Collins, thanks so much for talking to us today. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for having me on.
Right. So long.
That was Bill Resnick and Chuck Collins, followed by Thelonious Monk and Sonny Rollins, and we all want to be happy. I'm Fran Michel. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. We come to you every Monday at 9 a.m. on KBOO Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. Later today, we'll hear from Dan Jaffe and Russell Lum from the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign about Trump's recent renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement and what it means for capital, labor, and the environment. But next up, we'll hear from Tom Becker about why the Constitution won't save us from Trump.
Thank you, Fran. Can the United States truly be called a democracy? Today, I'm reading an article that argues that such is not the case. The article compares 18th century Britain and 21st century America, arguing that both are plutocracies hiding behind a thin veneer of democratic-sounding laws and principles. The article is entitled, Here's Why America's Constitution Won't Save Us from Trump, by J.M. Opel, Associate Professor of History at McGill University. When it comes to our democracy, problems at home were much like the 18th century Britain, Opel begins. A decade ago, as the scale of the disaster in Iraq began to sink in, American historians often compared the United States to ancient Rome. Both seemed to suffer from an imperial disease whose symptoms began with overreach and ended in collapse. This is a useful way for Americans like me to consider our troubles abroad. But when it comes to our democracy's problems at home, the closer parallel is with 18th century Britain. Britons of that time enjoyed many liberties unknown to their favorite bogeyman, the French. These freedoms have many roots, including the Magna Carta of 1215, the Bill of Rights from 1689, and various parts of English common law. Most Britons saw their country as God's favorite and thanked their constitution, a general term for established forms of law and government, for their rising glory. Yet for all the liberties it tolerated, that constitution's real goal was to shield wealth and privilege from popular demands. In the House of Lords, the privileged group was the aristocracy that still owned about 80% of all the arable land in England. In the House of Commons, the favored ones were rising merchants, bankers, and industrialists. Together, these old and new elites ran the show. For example, British law treated labor organizations as conspiracies, while respecting the fortunes that stockholders made as untouchable. A brutal criminal code complemented a draconian view of poverty. Strict suffrage laws and rotten boroughs insulated real power from the political circus, not to mention the angry crowds that rose up against everything from low wages to high bread prices and to anti-poaching laws. In 1870, a crowd of perhaps 60,000 rampaged through London, at first targeting Catholics, but quickly moving on to the Bank of England and the notorious Newgate Prison, where they said their honest comrades were held. Once the storm passed, though, nothing changed. By then, the American revolutionaries had given up on the British model. They dreamed of a republic, literally the public thing, where the common good overruled selfish demands and private interests. After the American Revolution, this U.S. Constitution of 1787 seems to fulfill these hopes by rejecting aristocratic titles and naming the people as the basis of authority. Yet the same Constitution protected both slaveholders and bondholders. It prohibited all kinds of popular interventions into the economy, and it arranged the federal government so that the general will of the population was divided, filtered, and ultimately restrained. In this sense, it simply updated British constitutional forms for American conditions, in which land was plentiful, labor was scarce, and white skin rather than high birth conferred status. During periods of democratic renewal, such as Reconstruction, the New Deal, and the Civil Rights era, American politics pushed the Constitution beyond its original intentions. In these creative moments, active citizens shaped a more just society. But over the last 50 years, another alliance of old and new has taken up arms, sometimes literally, behind the constitutional bulwarks, rolling back much of that progress. This alliance includes the white voters who keep their traditional supremacy through gerrymandered districts, restrictive voting laws, and mass incarceration of non-white people. It also includes corporate interests that halt efforts to protect workers and the environment, say nothing of sick, poor, and elderly Americans. The plutocrats not only decide elections with their campaign contributions, but also write legislation through their lobbyists. As a now-famous study from 2014 empirically shows, majority needs and wishes in the United States have virtually no impact on public policy, regardless of which celebrity candidate wins office. In America now, just as in Britain then, most people object. They would rather have clean air and water, secure jobs and pensions, and a fair distribution of wealth. They would rather not see most of their fellow citizens living one paycheck to the next, nor watch school children prepare for their next mass shooting. They prefer to live in a good society rather than a great power. But in America now, just as in Britain then, the political system won't allow it. Even if non-white majorities pile up in some congressional districts, the Senate and Electoral College will neutralize them. Even if dozens of Bernie Sanders acolytes get into office, their ideas will run aground in congressional committees awash in corporate influence. And if progressive hopes ever made it onto the books, federal courts stocked with hard right judges will strike them down, no matter what kind of blue wave arrives in 2020, 2024, or even 2040. In short, there is no reason to assume that under the current Constitution, the demographic and cultural challenges of the past generation will fundamentally challenge Donald Trump's America. After all, the British Constitution of the 1700s held firm through much of the 1800s, despite the upheavals of the Industrial Revolution. It gave ground in periodic reform acts, but otherwise kept democracy at bay. The people had to settle for their pride in their empire, their disdain for other countries, and their sense that as Britons, they're at least free to start over in Canada or Australia or even the United States. This article is entitled, Here's Why America's Constitution Won't Save Us from Trump, by J.M. Opel, Associate Professor of History at McGill University. The article was originally published on The Conversation.
You're trying to tell me capital has won at last. Anyone who's not convinced has just been shown the door. You're trying to tell me competition turns the wheels. Smart money never deals in welfare anymore. Survival of the fittest keeps the species strong. Change is always painful, but it doesn't last too long. Excuse me, friend, I think you could be wrong. When some of us are free to rise and some are free to fall, all of us are under the dictatorship of capital.
That was Alistair Hewlett with The Dictatorship of Capital. And before that, Tom Becker reading from history professor J.M. Opel's discussion of why the American Constitution won't save us from Trump. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, and I'm your host today, Fran Michel. You can find this show and its component parts online in a day or two via the Old Mole Variety Hour pages on the website for KBOO Portland at kboo.fm. You can also find those by visiting, liking, and following the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and following us at Old Mole on Twitter. Finally today, we welcome Dan Jaffe and Russell Lum of the Oregon Fair Trade Coalition to discuss the significance of Trump's renegotiation of NAFTA.
I'm Dan Jaffe for the Old Mole. On September 30th, Donald Trump announced that the U.S., Mexico, and Canadian governments had agreed on the text of a renegotiated NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement. Many will remember that NAFTA was passed back in 1993, pushed by Bill Clinton, in spite of adamant opposition from organized labor and environmental groups who predicted it would lead to job losses, falling wages, threaten national sovereignty. And NAFTA has removed tariffs. It has linked the three economies much more closely. It has deregulated trade, and it's increased the rights for corporations and investors. Now, 24 years later, NAFTA has suddenly been torn up and redone. What's in this new plan, and what are the implications? And to help sort that out, my guest, Russell Lum, is the Trade Justice Coordinator of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, a coalition of labor, environmental, and human rights groups that advocates on trade policy issues. Welcome, Russell.
Thank you, Dan. Pleased to be here.
So let's start out briefly. What has been the legacy of NAFTA after 24 years? What has been the impact in Mexico, in the U.S., and maybe here in Oregon in particular? And how does that contrast with the promises that were made back when Clinton signed the deal?
Isn't that the critical question is if we're taking this approach to NAFTA and if we're demanding an alternative to NAFTA, really, what's the big grievance? I sometimes don't know whether to sort it out as broken promises from the way NAFTA was sold or simply outright deceptions from a NAFTA model that free trade-minded people who run the global economy, who are neoclassical economics influenced, and who have the sway of most of the governments of the world, whether these were merely their intents. But certainly one of the intents was to turn Mexico into an export engine for the global north countries. And this entailed, hand-in-hand with agricultural subsidies and agribusiness favorable policies to United States interests, it entailed uprooting folks from their agrarian livelihoods in Mexico and sort of driving them to an export-driven and assembly-driven Mexican economy that put people in sweatshops that put people in highly, highly exploitive labor conditions in the maquiladora economy. So Mexico is, and Mexico, I think, partly in NAFTA's origins, was designed to be kind of this low-wage labor sink for other countries. We have seen that. Contrary to maybe promises that this would develop Mexico and maybe increase wages with that kind of development word being used, contrary to the increase in Mexican wages, the average Mexican worker is making 9% less than they were in 1993. That's sort of how we characterize it in terms of Mexico, an uprooting of local livelihoods, a worsened economic opportunity and economic gain for normal Mexican folks. And in our country, job loss. The deindustrialization pattern of the last 30 years was accelerated by NAFTA. NAFTA was designed to help, like I say, accelerated in the sense that the U.S. wasn't producing its own stuff. The U.S. was relying on Mexico and repeating this pattern for other countries, right, south of Mexico and on down, to have those low-wage countries produce stuff.
And how about here in Oregon? I know that ORFTC has worked a lot on the impact of NAFTA right here and job loss here in Oregon. What are the statistics for Oregon?
Yeah, Oregon has seen the same effects of the NAFTA era being hard on the pocketbook of regular people. So Oregon's richest 10% now capture over 46% of the state's income, whereas they captured 39% of the state's income prior to NAFTA. So there's sort of the broad picture about wealth being sucked from working class folks and from middle class folks to the top. But we've seen 12,000 manufacturing jobs in Oregon lost due to NAFTA. We've seen more than 68,000 jobs across the economy lost directly due to trade policy in the NAFTA era. And a lot of these are, let's say, a wealth of pulp and paper producing jobs, metals manufacturing jobs, vehicle manufacturing jobs, telecom. Those unions that have seen their brother and sister union members lose their jobs, that have seen their factories shutter, that have seen work stoppages. That's some of the fuel that we run on in Oregon Fair Trade Campaign to talk about that side of the story for us here in Oregon.
Well, let's talk specifically about what is new in Trump's NAFTA 2.0, which they are calling the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA. How much is new? What's new? And how much is the same old NAFTA?
Yeah, that's a very good question and kind of a long answer in the respect that there are some things in this new NAFTA which we're expecting to be signed later this month and which will go forth to the respective legislatures of the signing governments early next year. We are seeing some things which are better. We're seeing some things in trade agreements that we've long demanded. However, in a larger package that doesn't change the failed trade model that we've been identifying all these years. It's not a good agreement in that respect. It's got some improvements, but in a larger package that continues the loss of jobs, that continues the depression of wages, that continues a disrespect of human rights and migrant rights, and it continues the legacy of environmental damage. So if those things aren't transformed, groups like ours are going to say, well, we're not seeing enough. Here are the things that progressive groups, that labor groups, that environmental groups, that climate-minded groups have been saying about trade policy for 15 years, for 25 years. Where are the results in the new NAFTA? The record's mixed, but we're not sold. And so that having been said, when this comes down to being a fight in the U.S. Congress, it means asking members of Congress to hold the line on these things which we're holding the line on, and we're going to contend in the arena of where this agreement's going to get approved, like Congress, saying, show us the results for how working people are going to benefit, including that working people are going to get their rights enforced in this agreement. One of the things that's supposedly better about NAFTA is the workers' rights component, but only if it's enforced or it's not worth the paper that it's written on.
Well, let's get a little more into those nuts and bolts, because I have a sort of a document here from one of the national groups that you work with, Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, and it's full of red X's and green check marks. And the green check marks are sort of things that trade justice activists have been asking for all along. And it's a real mix of reds and green. What are some of the positives here? Things that labor has actually been demanding over the last couple of decades.
Probably the most important thing that this new NAFTA improves upon is it nearly ends ISDS. And by that, we mean investor-state dispute settlement, the provision which NAFTA championed. NAFTA was the first major trade agreement to have it, and it being the provision that says corporations can sue governments. And it's not reciprocal. Governments can't sue corporations, and certainly workers can't sue corporations. But this is the feature of NAFTA and later trade agreements, that corporations can sue governments when they make grievance that some government act, usually a regulation in the public interest or a law in the public interest, interrupted their expectation of profit. We are seeing a new NAFTA which has almost removed ISDS with a loophole, with a carve-in for oil and gas industry, which we find unacceptable. But it is groundbreaking that the new NAFTA, especially because we've known that NAFTA has sort of been a blueprint for later trade agreements and later trade policy. So we'd love to see a diminished or removed ISDS as the blueprint for later trade agreements. And we think we sort of won that, if you will. So ISDS is rollback is important and is in the new NAFTA. Other things are, this is an agreement that has actually impressive language on demanding free and independent labor power in Mexico. As it stands, Mexican workers are sort of under the thumb of fake unions, are under the thumb of what are called protection contracts. A Mexican worker often doesn't know that they're actually in a union when they go and work at, say, some factory. These unions are perfectly in line with their employer's interest. This new agreement, on paper, it says that that Mexican workers will have the ability to call those so-called unions to election, and if they're not, be replaced by independent unions. This is something that labor long wanted to try to stop the race to the bottom. What is attractive about Mexico for so-called investors? What's attractive about Mexico for manufacturers that causes them to move plants out of the U.S. into Mexico in the first place? It's working conditions and worker pay, and for Mexicans to be able to stand up and assert their rights over that is very, very important for folks on both sides of the border.
Some of the other elements that I know that organized labor is happy about or likes in this new agreement sort of connect to this Trump's sort of economic nationalist America First stance, right? This idea of the U.S. is sort of getting taken advantage of by the whole rest of the world and sort of bring jobs back home and playing to the deindustrialized sectors. I mean, there's some assurance that a higher percentage of automobiles will now be manufactured in higher wage settings and similar things. Say a little bit more about what this does for labor rights. And how we should understand that.
Yeah, you've raised the other quite interesting point that the new NAFTA has a wage floor for a certain sector. It has a wage floor, meaning that in the auto sector, if you're going to produce a so-called NAFTA car, if you're going to produce a car that carries the benefits of its tariff-free status being from the NAFTA region, then 40% of its value has to be produced by workers making 16 or more an hour. So that either dictates a rapid rise in Mexican auto worker wages, or maybe you could say in the meanwhile it supports what are higher paying jobs in the United States and in Canada and kind of, in a sense, protects them. Perspectives like ours would say that wage floors should be cross-sectoral. What's the principle behind a wage floor in a trade agreement? That people who do the work that the gains of the economy flow from ought to be able to have living wages, ought to be adequately compensated for contributing to things that we all benefit by. So the fact that it's kind of confined to the auto sector is a head scratcher. But no, that's a gain for it's a gain for labor.
How does corporate America view this new NAFTA agreement? Who wins? Who loses? Are there sectors of industry that are coming out better off in this agreement than others? Talk about some of that, some of how that plays out.
Yeah, and I think as I answer that, maybe I'll come around to answering sort of what really outweighs those apparently great things about the new NAFTA, right? Because like I'm saying, you know, organizations like ours are not impressed with the new NAFTA. Organized labor in particular is saying, hey, to our allies in Congress, what are you going to do to make this agreement better still? And so across the coalition of Oregon Fair Trade Campaign and of our partner groups, across these coalitions in the movement of movements that makes up trade justice, labor is saying it's not good enough. Environmental groups are saying it continues environmental damage. Climate justice groups are saying it's not good enough, and on and on. And so I think it does fall back to those sort of traditional lines of civil society saying this is a bad trade model and big business saying this is the only way we can do it, folks. Because to answer your question, corporate interests have got enough of what they wanted out of this agreement to have come out championing it, to come out saying that we're going to push for its passage as soon as it's taken up by the legislatures. If there's a corporate loser, if you will, well, the auto industry, because of some of the very things that we've already talked about, like increased auto rules of origin and a wage floor for auto workers. So the auto industry finds this agreement tolerable, but they have groaned of some of the apparent hits that they feel they're going to take if this were to become the new norm. But every other big business sector that you can think of has spoken only very favorably of this agreement. Oil and gas wins very, very big in the new NAFTA, alarmingly. There's an article on oilprice.com if you care to go there. And the headline of the article on oilprice.com is "Oil Majors Win Big in New NAFTA Deal," and this is an industry article for its own sector, right? And there's a subheading in the article which says, "Many wins, the environment loses."
There are other sectors as well that seem to do quite well. Talk a little bit about how it benefits big pharma, big ag and food, banking and financial services.
Yeah, those are on my list. Those are definitely sectors that come away very pleased with this new NAFTA. Pharmaceutical companies, which are at least the global sort of trade dynamics around pharmaceuticals, is that U.S. pharma kind of pushes the rest of the world to be heavy on biologic patents. And this has a really, really aggressive 10-year patent for new biologics, meaning that certain life-saving medicines can only be in the hands of their corporate originator instead of generics. Meaning that a lot of folks will not have access to affordable medicine across the border. A big pharma is pleased. And copyright interests across the board are pleased. That extends to the finance industry. That extends to the tech industries, from software to digital trade to like web giants like Amazon and Facebook. Their lobbying was successful as far as getting a hearing with the Trump people to get their interests fit into this new NAFTA.
And then dairy is a big one. I know that Canada had to give a lot and allow its protected and regulated dairy market to have a lot more U.S. produced cheese and milk coming in.
Yeah, the agribusiness interests that are aligned with mega dairies, or the agribusiness interests that represent mega dairies, wanted to be able to treat Canada as a market, as an export ground, to sort of satisfy what is truly a dairy crisis in our country. However, family farm groups, small farm groups, have said, "Look, you can't export your way out of a volatile ag market. Exports are not the answer, or not the only answer." The ag interests that that we think stand up for regular folks, that we think stand up for other people than just corporate ag, are saying that, hey, that kind of interruption of Canada's dairy norm was not good policy nationally or internationally.
My guest is Russell Lum. He is the Trade Justice Coordinator of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, and we're talking about the renegotiated NAFTA 2.0. Let's very, very briefly talk about Mexico and the political context in Mexico. Mexicans in July elected a new left-leaning president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He has been very critical of NAFTA, and particularly agriculture being included in NAFTA. And yet, AMLO, his initials, his incoming government, which is not in yet, did not really get involved in these negotiations, sort of kept hands off. How do we make sense of the incoming left government in Mexico and its stance on this renegotiation of NAFTA?
Yeah, well, to say that AMLO's incoming folks were hands-off is actually kind of a generous way of putting it. AMLO's incoming administration actually tried to hurry this agreement along and tried to work towards its completion so that basically the AMLO administration wouldn't be the one on the hook to actually sign it, wouldn't be the one on the hook to actually have said that we negotiated this. So... We're not pleased with AMLO's position. I mean, after decades of being critical of neoliberalism, he has certainly changed civil society's view of himself and undercut some of his own programs with this new favorability to NAFTA.
Before we wrap up, what do you expect to happen when NAFTA comes before Congress? Only have about 30 seconds. What should we expect to come next?
Oh, it could go so many different ways. And we're speaking just very, very close to Election Day, so we don't know what Congress's priorities towards NAFTA will be. But it could be a matter of getting, say, Democrats, say, Labor's allies in Congress to throw down and say, you know what, drastically make this a transformative agreement or be oppositional towards this agreement.
Well, I've been speaking with Russell Lum, the Trade Justice Coordinator for the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign. Thank you so much, Russell, and appreciate having you here on The Old Mole.
Absolutely. Glad to have been here.
Ministers meet, work on the movement of goods. Also work on the movement of capital. Also work on the movement of human beings. As if we were so many cattle. Grim travelers in dawn skies.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was Bruce Coburn doing Grim Travelers from his album Humans. Before that, we heard Dan Jaffe and Russell Lum discussing the significance of Trump's revised version of NAFTA. You can find that and all of today's segments on the web pages for the Old Mole Variety Hour at kboo.fm, or you can subscribe there to the show and have it all delivered weekly to your device of choice. I'm Fran Michel. I've been your host today. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Kullberg, and to our editor, John Nelson. Thanks to Bill Resnick, Chuck Collins, Tom Becker, Dan Jaffe, and Russell Lum. Thanks to Zoe Leonard, Bernice Johnson-Reagan, Sonny Rollins, Thelonious Monk, Alistair Hewlett, Bruce Coburn, and you, KBOO's listeners, members, supporters. The Mole will be back next Monday with more views, reviews, and interviews. Stay tuned to KBOO. At 10 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks to organizers and healthcare professionals about the benefits of the Clean Energy Initiative, Measure 26201. At 11, the Radio Zine welcomes author Philip Kenny to discuss his new book, The Writer's Crucible, Meditations on Emotion, Being, and Creativity. And at 11:30, Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside of Mental Health. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
woke up, it was a Chelsea morning, and the first thing that I heard was a song outside my window.
Help me, I think I'm falling in love again.
California, coming home. Ooh.
Hi, I'm Ed Melnick, your host for the singer-songwriter edition of the Monday Sampler. Joni Mitchell, winner of 9 Grammy Awards, is one of the most revered singer-songwriters in the last 50 years. In celebration of Joni Mitchell's 75th birthday, I've put together a special program featuring some of her known and not-so-well-known music. I hope you'll join me Monday, November 5th, from 2 to 4. Let's celebrate Joni's birthday together.
KBOO is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide. This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KBOO has been showing up for over 50 years. Give to KBOO today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten-Free Gem, Wee Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give or call 503-231-8032. Support KBOO, where music makes the movement.
KBOO Portland.